Welcome, everybody, to a Baseball America podcast, along with J.J. Cooper. I'm John Manuel. Thanks so much for the download or for downloading us on iTunes or baseballamerica.com. Excited for this time of year, spring training, Major League Baseball games on MLB Network. Very exciting to watch, or on your, of course, local cable providers with, like, Yes Network,
or
all these kind of things.
I was going to say, I've been
MLB.tv is on a lot of our phones.
Hard.
Absolutely. So it's just a really fun time of year when that just starts to get going. And, you know, some of us here in the office, some years we go to spring training, some years we don't. This year I don't think either of us is going to spring training, but so much to consume from afar. And then, of course, with us, with the draft and with college baseball, there's so much college baseball to go to. It's not quite the same newness as it is for people who just check in, who are only getting their first baseball fix with spring training, JJ, but there's obviously something different when they actually start playing spring training games.
Oh, yeah. It's, well, for one, it's always fascinating. There's always going to be one or two injuries that you didn't know about.
Right.
And well, in a lot of cases that the players didn't know about.
Right.
We've had a couple this year. Alfredo Severio was hurt in a car wreck that at least I don't think that anyone had publicly known about, but he's going to miss time into the season. Matt West, who was really kind of our pick to really...
He was a breakout. He was a fanciful breakout selection.
And he's not going to break out this year, it doesn't look like. Instead, he's been shut down, and they hope to avoid Tommy John surgery. But if not, it's Rangers, you know, relief pitcher, Rangers right-hander, who had a chance to move really quick. He's going to move a lot slower now, it looks like.
Yeah, and for a converted guy where there was a possibility of him going basically from short season ball last year to the major leagues, not to start the
year,
but major leagues sometime during 2012, clearly the Rangers thought pretty highly of him. And so that's one less arrow in the Rangers' quiver. We did have kind of the first sensation, I guess, of spring training. Really, JJ was Yu Darvish's first start. Might be worth touching on him because we are talking in this podcast and in our most recent issue, our Major League Preview, about top 20 rookies. Our Major League Preview is really focused on rookies because it dovetails nicely with what we do. Yu Darvish came in second. We picked Matt Moore first. But Yu Darvish certainly didn't do anything in his first two-inning outing facing live batters to tamp down expectations both in Dallas-Fort Worth and in the rest of the country.
Absolutely not. I'll put it this way. If you're a Rangers fan, you know you've made the World Series back-to-back years. It's sure hard not to dream on, okay, well now if you add him to the front of the rotation, how much of a difference is that going to make? And it's two innings.
Right.
It's
right.
Two innings, but those two innings aren't anything out of that. It's not like something where you say, well, that's so far beyond what you can expect out of Yu Darvish that don't get excited. No, he was what you can expect. He's not going to be that great as he was for those two innings every outing, but
right.
He's got ace stuff.
I'm looking forward to the hair. You know, I'm going to do it anyway, but I mean, like, John Travolta, when I talk about hair, I think of, I worked hard on my hair, and he touched it, you know. He looks like he works pretty hard on his hair, Yu Darvish.
Well, Yu Darvish
put some thought into his hair.
I'll say this, the one thing that
I think he has Jeremy Lin. Jeremy Lin's a different story, but baseball's looking for, like, its version of someone to market and for people to go kind of crazy over. He has that potential.
The thing I'll say for Darvish, a lot of times when you have a player coming over, it's not that they haven't been stars in their, you know, wherever they've come. Ichiro was a star before he hit the U.S.
Correct.
You know, Yoenis Cespedes was a star in Cuba before he came to the U.S. But Yu Darvish has been kind of a pop star in Japan.
Since he was 18. I mean, Daisuke was similar.
Right.
Daisuke was a national hero in high school.
Right.
It would have been like the analogy is kind of like a Kemba Walker almost. I mean, their national high school tournament is their March Madness in Japan, and he starred and carried his team to championships in that arena. I guess it was one championship.
But so with Darvish, one thing you don't really have, to me, much of a concern at all about is how is he going to handle being in the spotlight? That part is That's no different for him. Oh, look, there's a 1,000 media following his every move. Well, that was true in Japan before.
I do wonder, I'd like to ask, and I'll have to ask some of the Japanese media that we do know, like how different is it for players in the U.S. where they are in the fishbowl, though, a little bit? I mean, they're followed certainly all the way in Japan. But here, if you're Yu Darvish and you're seeing all the Japanese media in Surprise, Arizona, you know they're there for you. They're not there for... Do the Royals still have a... They had a Yabuda guy a couple years ago. He's not there anymore. There are no more Japanese pitchers in Royals camp, are they?
No.
I mean, so they're there for you, Darvish. I do think it's still a little different, and there's obviously the cultural assimilation part to it, but as we've written about, you, Darvish, has some advantages there. Both his parents attended college in the United States. They actually met at Eckerd College in Florida. So you, Darvish... is a little bit more worldly. Plus, his father is Iranian, Persian, I actually should say.
Right.
He's from Iran, but is of Persian ethnicity. So he's got he's not the same as Daisuke Matsuzaka. He's not the same as a pitcher. He's not the same culturally or personality-wise, and he's not going to Boston. So I do think that the biggest thing that's going to help him be more successful than Daisuke Matsuzaka is the fact that Nolan Ryan, and you wrote about this, Nolan Ryan has established that the Rangers are a flexible organization when it comes to developing pitchers. Pitchers can show the Rangers that what they do works for them. Correct. They didn't sign. This is not going to be one of these deals where they sign Yu Darvish and they tell him to do something different than what made him successful in Japan. They might adjust maybe an approach in terms of like throwing pitches to hitters. But they're not. They aren't taking away pitches yet, JJ.
But
they're not changing his training.
But there's one thing we have to address that is changed, and it's not because the Rangers changed it. The thing we have to see that he has to adjust to is it's a different schedule.
Definitely.
And so you can't do the same. You can't say, well, I'm going to take the program that worked for me in Japan and just bring it over.
Right.
Because if you do,
you can't do the
you're
same
not going to be
schedule.
Ready to start.
That's right. No, you're absolutely right. That's a great point. That held true for Daisuke. And I, you know, there was all that talk. Remember in his first spring training, where I was like, man, Daisuke, you're really throwing a lot too much. And there were all these meetings with him and John Farrell and Francona, Theo Epstein. You know, I don't think you're going to see those. If you see those meetings with the Rangers, A, they'll probably be less public because of the Rangers. They're not the Red Sox. It just is what it is. The Red Sox have just so much. They've been dealing with that kind of attention since 1960-something, you know, probably since 67. And then the Reds, the Rangers, I think they handle this a little bit differently. They don't have as much attention, and there is just an attitude with their organization of, again, like you said, trusting their pitchers and wanting to let their pitchers succeed rather than making sure their pitchers succeed their way. I guess that's the way I would put
right,
it.
And so,
I think that's changing around the game, but I think the Rangers are at the vanguard of that, and I think Darvish will be a really intriguing test of that.
Which, what we're saying is we expect Darvish to be excellent this year.
Yeah, no doubt.
And what that means also is we really expect Matt Moore, who I know has been slowed a little bit spring training with an injury that really should not bother him long-term at all. But we do – the top of this list, Matt Moore, Yu Darvish – I think are the two guys who we expect this year really to be impact rookies.
Yeah, I think that for me, it was a really close call between Moore and Darvish. And I think the fact that they're both on really good teams helped them be toward the top of this list. And in fact, might have been the biggest the difference maker for me between those guys and Jesus Montero. I think a little higher of Montero than you do. I think Montero's going to be a monster. I think he's going to be outstanding this year. I think he's ready to contribute as a rookie. It wouldn't shock me if he hit 20 home runs and drove in close to 100 runs and hit close to 300 even this year as a rookie.
I'll give you everything except I don't think he's going
to you won't give me 300.
I won't give you 300 this year. Not down the road, but this year. I do think, though, how they're handling him is a really smart way of doing it.
And that's one of the reasons why.
You're not giving up on catching. You're not saying you're not a catcher. But what you are saying is
your job is to hit.
Your job is to hit. We'll keep you behind the plate enough so it's not like something where we're giving up on it. But the other smart thing with that is and we're not going to give you a position that you have to learn on the fly either.
Right.
You're going to be a catcher/DH, emphasis on DH.
Right.
Your job is our offense has been terrible. disastrous.
So
you fix that, please.
And I think he's very well suited to do that, and I'm not judging that based off what he did in September. The guy's just track record is that he's hit. He's hit at every level. And I'm not going to say it like Shaq. I won at every level except for college and high school. But Jesus Montero hit at every level. And I also feel like, again, I know I sound like Matt Eddy on this, but 2 years of AAA, he's very prepared. And he's as prepared as he could be to hit in the big league. So to me, if he had been in New York with the short porch and right field, that team where it's such a left-handed lineup outside of A-Rod and Jeter, and they really could have used right-handed power, he would have been number one on my list if he were still a Yankee. I do feel that the move across – first of all, you're going across country. Being traded, I think, is not easy for 21-, 22-year-olds. Yeah, I think he'd been dreaming for 5 or 6 years that he was going to be a Yankee. And that lineup affords a lot more opportunities to be good, where he's not going to be the best. He goes into Seattle, he's instantly probably the second-best hitter on their team after Dustin Ackley.
Right.
We'll see what Ichiro does this year. They're talking about dropping him to the three-hole, but I think Montero's going to hit the ground really. I'd say running, but he's slow. So I think he's going to hit the ground and be good from day one, just like Matt Moore and just like Yu Darvish.
And then after that, the toughest guy I'd say probably on this list, we had Mike Trout, number four.
Yeah, this
that is where it really becomes difficult, because we're trying to do a top 20 rookies. And I think we've talked about this in the office. We have a little bit of different philosophies as far as what we're trying to say with the top 20 rookies. That if we're ranking them, Mike Trout is going to, going to be higher than four.
Right. If we're just ranking him on prospectiness, certainly he wouldn't be.
But the reality of it is that you look at the Angels and you can map out a pretty easy scenario where Mike Trout ends up getting 300 at-bats this year.
I think you could map out a scenario where Mike Trout doesn't really come up till September. I mean, even if he's just destroying Salt Lake, because
I
expect him to do that. It's plausible he could repeat as minor league player of the year. It is plausible, even though he's number four on our list.
Greg Jeffries and Andrew Jones, only two.
Hey, those are the only two. I don't have any faith in Vernon Wells. And we don't have faith in Vernon Wells, and that's why Mike Trout's fourth on this list. But if Vernon Wells is closer to 2010 Vernon Wells than 2011 Vernon Wells, how are they going to bring him up? If Peter Borges has at least the kind of year he had last year or progresses, there is no room at the end for Mike Trout on that big league roster. We're expecting his talent to force him through Wells to stink.
But the other thing that just has to happen, the other way it can happen, which I think is almost as plausible, is all he needs, because he can play any one of those three spots.
Right.
All he needs is one of those guys to go on the 15-day DL.
Wouldn't Bob Abreu get a possibility to play out there? I know he's just as old, he's older than Vernon Wells, but wouldn't Bob Abreu get the? They don't have a consistent place to put Bob Abreu in their lineup.
Right.
They're paying him a decent amount of money.
And he's expecting.
And they have. And they also
Mark
in the
Trumbull.
Corners are going to try Mark Trumbull up there. I just think the line of players there is so deep. But for me, that team is expecting to compete, obviously. And if Vernon Wells is not getting the job done, to me, they'll suck up the money. And if they don't get off to a good start, they're going to go to Mike Trout as that igniter.
Right.
That's why I voted him so high on my top 20. But I think it's extremely plausible, JJ, that he is not even in our final 20 at the end of the year. And that, he's still not going to be prospect eligible, but it's very plausible that he only plays a handful of games before September. Because that team, Bob Abreu might have a dead cat bounce. So Vernon Wells might too. This is your phrase. I have personal cheese ball. You have a dead cat bounce. Because I'd never heard that before you. Did you make that up?
No, it's a stock
in
trader.
In Georgia?
No.
It's a stock trader. Okay.
Like, oh, stock has a dead cat bounce. Like, so basically went down to 75 cents, went up to $1.20. Okay, it's dead.
That was a
dead cat bounce. Because even if even a dead cat will bounce.
I haven't come over that phrase in the Michael Lewis books that I've read, but maybe I'm not reading the right
ones.
But
the thing that jumped out after that is number five is Yoenis Cespedes. Three A's on this list. We could have potentially gone even deeper than that in A's, because the thing that the A's have is there's opportunity.
They have a virtual Statue of Liberty standing in the bay. Give me your tired, your poor,
your rookies.
Cuban, your rookies. Come on, we got opportunity here.
Jared Parker, you got an opportunity. Brad Peacock, you've got an opportunity. Suspettus,
you've got an opportunity. Michael Taylor, you've
Tom
got an opportunity.
Tom Malone, you have an opportunity. There's going to be plenty of opportunities there.
I just went Oprah on you. I can't believe I just went Oprah. What's up with that?
But, and of that group, it's funny, like, Suspettus has yet to play in a, as we record this, yet to play in an official spring training game. He did have a monstrous B game. Well, even a B game, simulated game, I believe
right.
it was. Which I love that about spring training.
He likes everything simulated.
I love
simulated workouts, simulated game. He's very good at those.
But I do love though that the and hey, it was good reporting. You should if a guy hits a pair, if a guy who's yet to play in a game, so everyone's interested in him, hits a pair of home runs in a workout, you mention it.
Correct.
But it is funny right now just how It's what's great about spring training is how the minutest things that in regular season kind of whatever right now are important.
It's a melange of outfielders in Oakland.
Seth Smith, Coco Crisp, Josh Reddick, Colin Cowgill.
Yeah, I mean,
I'll put it this way: if you expect the A's to be better than awful this year, because I think there's a lot of expectation that, especially in that division, they're going to be pretty bad. Suspettus is going to have to be a big part of it because he's the there's not a whole lot of cornerstone guys in that lineup.
Well, of course, the other one that everyone wants to see, and I think it's funny that he's not on their 40-man roster as of right now as we record this, is Manny Ramirez.
I'll put it this way. He's not a cornerstone guy now.
I know. I'm just saying but that's a whole other dimension to me of the Suspettus story. It's an odd choice of mentor. You know, Jermaine Dye, you couldn't go get Jermaine Dye. If you want a right-handed power old guy who used to play for the White Sox, you know, how about Jermaine Dye? I'm just surprised that that was the choice that the A's made. I guess, they are the A's. They're smarter than everybody else. So I don't really think they think that anymore, but I think there are still – it was a curious choice. To me, when you have so many rookies around, my first choice – a veteran off the scrap heap to take a chance on would not be the guy who's known for being corrosive in the clubhouse on winning teams with in a good situation with really good clubhouse guys where he'd won and made hundreds of millions of dollars. And that was what Manny Ramirez was in Boston. So I don't think he's humbled necessarily by his suspensions. So if he makes that team as on that roster – he just is not. He wouldn't be my first choice.
No,
I'm surprised they put him. That the A's of all teams signed him with all those rookies around.
And especially because at this point, to me, the problem with it is that there's not a whole lot of upside to it. The likelihood that Manny Ramirez is going to be the Manny that we remember,
right,
is very, very small at this point. He's old enough now that the reality is that even if you do take wonderful care of yourself and all, it's really hard to produce.
And I'm saying, I mean, you need a right-handed hitter in your outfield. Why wouldn't you give those at-bats to a younger guy like a Michael Taylor or a Colin Cowgill and see what you have? Or if you have
DH
you want to play. He's not going to play the outfield. I'm just saying, why wouldn't you give those at-bats to? You have Jermaine Mitchell. He's 27 years old, and he's been in your organization since I did their top 10. That's how long it's been. He was in the top 10 in the year that I did the A's. That's like 6 years ago. So why wouldn't you give that guy some at-bats? Why wouldn't you give that guy some run? You know, you have Chris Carter and Keelah Cahoui and Brandon Allen. And give those guys some run and see what you have at the DH spot as opposed to Manny. That one, it's a small signing. It's just a vexing
right, and
signing.
We don't even know right now he's going to make the roster. So
right.
this could be a tempest
right.
in a spring training
teapot. It could be. I wouldn't want him around my camp. So we'll see how that plays out. I have a feeling that would be really interesting to make, to see how he affects Yoenis Céspedes.
So who on this, getting past the top five, who on this list stands out to you? By the way, if you were listening to this and you haven't seen the list, just go to baseballamerica.com. We
yep.
have it up on the major season preview drop-down. We have all of our season preview coverage. But who jumps out to you as someone who you wouldn't be surprised if, when we're all said and done, if we're voting them Rookie of the Year?
Yonder Alonso. And he's at 11, and Bryce Harper at 10. Harper's the obvious answer because I believe in Bryce Harper as far as I don't think he's going to go out there and hit 220 or 230. I think he's better than Justin Upton. I mean, that was what we talked about in our office. Hey, you know, teenagers.
A-Rod and Justin Upton are
those
two
good examples. I've been talking about Bryce Harper as the A-Rod, the next A-Rod, for several months, about how, like, he's going to be the guy that people love to hate. Did you see that he was quoted the other day saying that himself? He intends to be A-Rod. I mean, I think Bryce Harper's going to be... I think he's going to be good from day one.
I do think that he has a little bit more self-awareness about who... A-Rod was A-Rod without trying... A-Rod wanted to be liked.
Correct.
And was incapable of...
And I will make the analogy that A-Rod, to me, was a lot like kind of a Chris Webber, in that Chris Webber didn't know how to be street. He wanted to be Jalen Rose, but I think A-Rod wanted to be a tough guy, and he's just not.
But he wanted to be a tough guy, but at the same time, I think A-Rod wanted to be the face of baseball,
yeah,
the Cal Ripken. I think he wanted the next Cal Ripken, the guy who everyone in baseball says that is the ambassador of baseball.
You mean like Derek Jeter?
Right. That's what he wanted to be.
Right.
And it just wasn't to be. But
it's
he was trying. Bryce Harper's not saying I want to be the Cal Ripken. I don't think Harper's saying I know that. There's going to be people who don't like me. Bring it on. I want to be the best player in baseball. And
the difference is that, he's kind of like, unlike LeBron James. I know we're going a lot of sports analogies here. He won't mind being the villain, A. B, it's his style of play that will be very different from Alex Rodriguez's, because it's kind of – because he talked about he
Bryce
wants
Harper,
to be Pete Rose. He plays like Pete Rose.
Bryce Harper – the funny thing – and that is the
he
funny
just,
part
he
of
just
it.
He just hits like George Foster in 1977.
Right, but the funny thing about that is that – and there is, I think, some truth to that. Pete Rose – if you said how Pete Rose played and you compare it to how Bryce Harper the perceptions out there that are negative about Bryce Harper – there's a lot of similarities.
Absolutely. Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Pete Rose, the funny thing is, and this is what I've said about Bryce Harper, and I don't need to, if you listen to the podcast regularly, you've heard me say it on here before. Bryce Harper, all of the main problems with Bryce Harper that people have are things that if you are on the other team, you hate him. They're not things that if you're on his team, you necessarily hate him.
Because it's Rose, not a false hustle. It's
Pete
not
Rose...
False.
The same, you could say the same thing. If Pete Rose was on the other team, you hated him.
That's the difference with him and A-Rod. It's not a false hustle.
It's not slapping the ball out and saying you didn't slap it out. It's trying to run the guy over at first to get to be safe.
That's exactly what I was about to say. When A-Rod's trying to knock the ball out of Bronson Arroyo's hands, he kind of slaps at it like he's trying to slap the purse out of his hands. If Bryce Harper had been running to first base, Bronson Arroyo would have been
four rows back. Ray Fosse.
He'd have been five rows up in the stands.
It would have been Pete Rose rounding third
in
the All-Star game.
That's right. And that is the analogy. He would never – Bryce Harper, I don't think, would yell at somebody. And if Dallas Braden yelled at Bryce Harper, it would be on. That would be a bobblehead,
That's the thing we have to see.
Braden pulling up his shirt.
The thing we have to see is, again, the reports I'm getting that we're seeing out of spring training – we're seeing.
Yeah.
It's not like
that's
personal
okay.
reports. But the reports we're seeing, he's being, teased by the veterans and all, and he takes it. He's good-natured about it. He doesn't mind that. He knows he has to be put in his place. He understands. For one, that's another thing that A-Rod always had. He understands kind of how the dynamics of the clubhouse work.
Right.
Again, we'll have to see. Does that continue? He's going to be... Whenever he arrives this year, and it's going to be this year, barring injury.
Yeah.
Whenever he arrives, at the least, he's going to be the second biggest star on that team. And reality is he plays every day.
Right.
So he'll be a bigger star than Strasburg almost immediately.
He will be.
That being the case, how does teammates deal with it then? A lot of that comes down to if he hits you. I personally think I wrote it in the write up for him. The teenage record for big league homers in a season.
Yeah,
24. I don't think he's going to make – I think he could make a run at that. I don't think – the thing that's going to probably keep him from that is his Super 2 status.
Correct. I don't think there's any – I think if he were in 1978 before all this kind of stuff, I think that he would make a run at that.
The reality is that unless they make a move, which is shocking that they would considering he's not far away, it's really hard to argue that right now – and I know he didn't have a great second half in AA, but if you look at what they have right now – and you said, okay, so do you want Rick Ankiel in center and Jason Wirth in right?
Right.
Or Roger Bernardina in center and Jason Wirth in right? Or do you want Wirth in center, and Harper in right.
Well, I don't know if you want Wirth in center, but you'll figure something out.
But that's what you're going to do.
It is amazing. I still think if that's what it comes down to, David Johnson might do that for a week or so and then say, you know, Bryce, you're 10 times faster than Jason Wirth is right now, and that he's going to play some center field.
It may switch over.
I think he is going to play some center
field. I think he will play some, but I think they're going to start him out playing right.
That's certainly their intention. He has not played center field as a professional. But, he's played right and left.
But no, and I do think a little bit less. I think we both believe in the hit tool. We're both among the believer in the Bryce Harper hit tool. I do think, though, the number of – and I know he's a very special case, but the number of 19-year-olds who I think he's going to be extremely productive for a 19-year-old. I thought a good analogy that I think Matt Eddy brought up when we were doing our rookies meeting was, could he have a Mike Stanton rookie year?
That was
and
a great analogy.
To me, that's the upside. That's the upper end of what you're hoping for is that when Mike Stanton came up, Mike Stanton was the best power hitter in the Marlins lineup from the day he showed up, which isn't surprising considering he has 80 power.
Right.
But that year, he 259, 326, 507. If Bryce Harper does that as a 19-year-old, you're just counting on, okay, well, we're seeing the first season of a potential Hall of Famer.
And that's my point, is that I don't think that there's any reason why Bryce Harper can't hit around 250, 260. And that is very in line with my expectations of what he can do. And he won't strike out 123 times in 360 at-bats. He would strike out less.
I'll say this. Even if he did strike out 123, the thing that jumps out also is if he just replicated that, to do that as a 19-year-old, it's almost hard to say at that point. That's pretty much – he's lived up right there. It's like, okay, he's living up to every expectation you could have for him. And – because if he strikes out 123 times as a rookie 19-year-old with that kind of power,
that might be his career high.
That may be his career high, and you're going to see it just get better and better.
It's the Baseball America podcast with John Manuel and J.J. Cooper. We had the Reggie Jackson comp recently, but we could go on and on about Bryce Harper. I think you've all heard us talk about him a lot. I like Yonder Alonso, J.J., and we had a feature in here where that addresses this, but you know, Yonder Alonso has a decent amount of similarities to Adrian Gonzalez.
Yes, up on the website today, as we recorded this on Thursday.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to put Adrian Gonzalez expectations on him, but if you tick off a checklist of Adrian Gonzalez's characteristics, left-handed hitter who likes to use the whole field, check, Yonder Alonso does that. Patient plate approach, not afraid to take pitches, not afraid to work counts, check. That was Yonder Alonso. Had like a 60 walk year in college. I mean, he's always been a patient hitter. Bad body guy. Check in spades for both these guys. Failed experiment in the outfield. Let's not say failed. Let's say awkward experiment in the outfield. Check.
Trade cleared out the spot for them to go back to their natural spot.
Correct.
And they were blocked behind someone who was one of the top first basemen.
The main thing for me, the biggest similarity is the hitting ability was ahead of the raw power. And that is really that's what you have. And it's right there. And that's what I like about Yonder Alonso. That's why I think he's going to be successful. And he's 24. He's ready to be good from day one. So I expect him to be good as a rookie. He was a little bit lower on the list than I would have had him, but it's not my list. But I like Yonder Alonso as a guy who goes right in there and is really ready to hit. But we have an interesting piece also in the front of the Major League Preview issue. I'm not sure if this has made it online yet. But
that's going up on Tuesday.
The charts that Matt Eddy did about ballpark factors and these guys. And, if he has – so Adrian Gonzalez had a 127 ops plus and an 862 OPS and his first full season as a regular in 2006.
And the key thing is also at the age of 24.
Yeah, I think Yonder Alonso could approximate that. It would not shock me if he had that kind of year. It's interesting that
both of them came up.
That is.
And really, the career track is pretty similar there, too.
The amazing thing, the problem for him will be, and he's going to have this off-fields approach, worst parks for home runs by left-handed hitters, one target field, which was a little bit of a shock, considering that you're building that park and you had Joe Mauer and Justin Morneau and Jason Kubel, all homegrown guys, all on your roster at that time.
Oops.
A little tone deafness there by the Twinkies.
Not only that, but you had you know, like Joe Mauer is signed. Oh, he'll just be around for the next 8 years.
Well, yeah, obviously he wasn't signed to that contract yet when they
designed it. But
yeah, but yeah, to Target Field, the only tougher home run park for left-handed hitters than Petco, and Petco does not make it into the bottom five for right-handed hitters. So, you know, it's going to be he's going to have to use the entire field. But I think that he can. I think he can be that kind of guy, and I expect big things out of Yonder Alonso. I mean, he's a very, very good hitter, and the biggest difference to me is that Adrian Gonzalez is a better defender by a decent amount over Yonder Alonso. So that's a big difference. I think that Yonder Alonso will approximate Adrian Gonzalez offensively. I don't think he's ever going to be a 40 home run guy, but I think he'll approximate him offensively, and he'll be a lesser player defensively.
And I think he's the perfect fit. The trade for him was perfect because he went from being a square peg in a round hole because he would have been probably they would have tried him at left field, and I think that would have affected his offense because
right.
Yonder Alonso is not a left fielder
or a third base.
Now he gets to do what he actually can do, which is play first base, hit, and in the middle of a lineup before long. I really think and. And to me, the other guy that very similar to that, Zach Cozart is 26 already. The best way I can put it is
good point.
If Zach Cozart is not ready, Zach Cozart will never be ready.
Yeah, he'll be a career backup
right.
if he's not ready right now.
But that being said, I think he's got a chance to be the NL Rookie of the Year, and the reason I say that is he plays shortstop, so people value that, understandably.
He's on a contending team.
He's on a contending team, and... And the thing about it is he puts up counting numbers. I mean, we've gotten more sophisticated now, obviously,
right.
you know, with the voting and all this. That being said, when a shortstop puts up, I wouldn't be shocked at all to see him put up 15 homers this year.
Yeah, and I think the other
– that park especially.
The big question for me was Zach Cozart. I don't think there's a question that he's going to be a competent regular. The question for me is he going to be just along for the ride with the Reds? Or is he going to be an integral part to them winning a division? And I think the difference in that is how patient is he and can he be a leadoff guy if they need a leadoff guy?
Or number two. I think he's going to end up hitting number two for them a lot this year.
I think he'd be miscast as a leadoff guy. He has shown some patience in the past, but he's also had some years where he's
right.
been very aggressive.
I don't think the
reality they don't have any guys in
they
the,
don't have
at
a
the
leadoff,
top. That's right. They don't have
they don't have a leadoff
guy.
Hitter.
And I think he's as much of a leadoff hitter as Brandon Phillips is. I think he's much more of a leadoff hitter than Drew Stubbs is. So I think that's to me will be the difference. I think if he's just competent and is a 7 or 8 hitter, and it's tough to be an 8-hole hitter in the National League. There, guys talk about the challenges there. You're getting pitched around, you know, and there are other times when you're pitched to very aggressively. You know, it's hard for young players to get used to. I think he'd be capable. If he's a capable 7 or 8 hitter, that's one thing. But if he's good enough where Dusty Baker gives him some time at
the
first or second spot in the lineup, then I think he really does have a chance to be a rookie.
The interesting thing about that Reds lineup is you're right. They don't really have a true leadoff.
They don't.
The other interesting part of it is that if it all comes together, though, I don't know who bats 7th or 8th in that lineup.
Right. Their 7th or 8th. Their 8-hole hitter could be Mesoraco, who could also – he could be a monster in the 8-hole because a lot of 8-hole hitters see a lot of fastballs. That could be a beneficiary.
Because
Devin
they just don't like if you look at it, if Scott Rolen stays healthy, there is not if you put Cozart the thing that Cozart gives him is that they had nothing at shortstop last year. They had very natural 8-hole hitters at shortstop last year. What they have this year, if Cozart provides more than that, then what you're talking about is you are gonna have a lineup where you don't have an obvious out in the lineup.
Who was the biggest split guy between you and me? Was it Drew Pomeranz? Because I had Pomeranz shoved up my list pretty high, and I don't think you had him.
I don't think pitching in Coors, adjustments as a rookie, I think it's hard. I think it's hard to pitch in Coors as a rookie. He's going to get opportunities. That's definite. But I just think that at the end of the year, let's say he does make 30 starts, you know, 25, 30 starts.
Yeah.
I think it's 25, 30 starts with an ERA closer to 5 than 4.
I think he's going to be a 25 start, 4 ERA type of guy. I would feel better about him if he, you know, he relies so heavily on his curveball. It's going to be really intriguing to see if he can spin a curveball at altitude.
Right, because that's
but
a tough
the humidor
place.
Seems to have helped guys do that. So, you know, Jules Chassin put up a 142 ERA plus as a rookie there. You know, he had a 328 ERA, 362 last year. I think that Drew Pomeranz, Jules Chassin's really good. I think Drew Pomeranz can be better. I think he can go there and succeed as a rookie. So I like Drew Pomeranz's
and my
chances
thing is that,
but I think it's a very reasonable.
I think he's going to succeed. I don't know if it's going to
just
come as a rookie.
Not in 2012.
I think I was doing a little research on this, and it is notable just how many good pitchers struggle their first year, and a lot of good players, especially the starting pitchers. It can be a dramatic adjustment.
Your example that you gave the other day about the Tom Glavine's first three seasons. Was very telling.
Tom Glavine,
because he was horrible.
Tom Glavine did post. I know he was playing on bad teams, but Tom Glavine. Hey, let's be honest. That Rockies team this year
could be ugly.
But Tom Glavine didn't post an ERA plus over 100 until his fourth season. So there was a lot of slogging there, and which is actually not that shocking when you consider.
And the 2 years before that, they were in the 90s. He wasn't getting hammered, but he had like a year there. I guess it was actually his second year. He went 14-8, but had a terrible second half. And the next year kind of regressed a little bit, it seemed. But, I mean, he really actually held steady.
Oh, what
yeah,
do we
exactly.
have here?
We have a Cy Young Award winner here. The guys like Glavine, who struggle to figure it out the first couple of years and then are outstanding, you find, well, I'm not sure how to say this, because guys who are flash in the pan and are good for a year or two, and then the league adjusts. But that's not really what happened to Steve Avery. As I said, but Tom Glavine's more typical than Steve Avery, where you have instant
success.
My way
to put it is that...
Although I guess Avery had one really bad year.
My way to put it, and this is where it's tough to evaluate as far as this, this is why we love pitching. I'm not shocked when you have that soft-tossing lefty who comes up and has immediate success. I'm also quite skeptical a lot of times with those guys. Okay, are they going to be able to sustain it?
You mean young gun Chris Mihalik? That's an inside joke.
But you can have a lot of times that first five starts, you have almost a little bit of advantage because they don't have the scouting report on you yet. It's getting a little easier now because everything's out there now. But it is true where it's those first couple of starts, you go, wow, you really put something together there. And that doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to be able to sustain it. I mean, I just think, you know, just off the top of my head, Kirk Reeder, I remember having a dominant start.
I think
start.
He won like his first eight decisions in the major leagues.
And Kirk Reeder, we're not asking the question of, so which hat is he going to wear when he goes into Cooperstown?
Well, he's probably already in the Murray State Hall of Fame if you want to get March Madness about
it. Kirk Reeder, 8-0, 2.73 as a rookie, 7-3, 5.17 his second year. Kirk Reeder ended up being a solid, basically tick below average pitcher for a good while.
If Drew Pomeranz has a career that approximates Kirk Reeder, he'll probably end up being pretty happy about it. 130 wins, league average ERA over the course of 13 seasons.
Right.
He'd we expect better out of
but
Drew
that, but what I'm saying, though, is that Kirk Reeder was his best as a rookie.
Kirk Reeder is the ultimate, to me, like we should compare guys to Kirk Reeder instead of to Tom Glavine. We get all the Tom Glavine comps in the world. Kirk Reeder's like a good poor man, a good version
That's
of a poor
man. That's a different
man's.
Poor man. So we can put the Jeff Suppan comps away from Greg Maddux. We have the Jeff Suppan, Greg Maddux comps.
Yes, he is.
And we got the Kirk Reeder, Tom
Glavine.
He
is to Tom Glavine as Jeff Suppan is to Greg Maddux. I'm throwing that out there. I'm going to use that from now on. The other rookie to me, JJ, in our top 20, who was really divisive, well, there were a couple, but Jacob Turner was really divisive. I was surprised that Jacob Turner got less support. I think he has an obvious road to the fifth starter role in Detroit. I don't think he has a ton of competition. I think he has a low bar, and I think it's very possible that he could go out there and have a full ERA and win 10, 11, 12 games and be a very capable fifth starter for the Detroit Tigers this year.
Well, the good thing he's going to have for him is that he's going to be on a team that's going to score him a lot of runs.
Yeah, no doubt.
That being said, I guess I would say that I think why there was some resistance, part of it, he can blame on Rick Porcello.
Right.
Because there's been so many comps of him. He has a very similar approach. If you are taking the Jacob Turner scouting report right now and comparing it to the Rick Porcello scouting report, rewind it, I guess, 3 years. There's a lot of similarities.
I think he's more of a curveball guy than a slider guy, if memory serves. But Porcello was supposed to have a big-time curveball in high school as well. I mean, the breaking ball was supposed to be more of a swing-and-miss pitch for Rick Porcello. It's turned into more of a ground ball pitch as a professional.
Right, and that's the thing. Turner's, you know, what we've seen as he's climbed the ladder is it's become a little bit more he's been a weak contact guy, which we'll see. And then when he got to the big...
It's basically 8 strikeouts per 9 innings. I mean, it's 7.7. For, you know, over 246 innings pitched, I think that's a little too faint of praise. But he hasn't dominated.
And when he went to the big leagues, he got dominated.
Yeah, but he was 20 years old. No. Starts.
No, that's my thing is that it was 3 starts and he was 20 years old. I don't know if this year... I don't know necessarily if we know that he's... That there's this massive learning that came from those 3 starts where you say, okay, this year he's ready to make a big leap. He's going to be 21. It's hard to pitch in the big leagues at 21.
It is. To me, he doesn't have a ton of competition for that role either.
Oh, I think he's going to have opportunity.
Yeah.
I just don't know. The reason
and he's a
I was kind of.
Top 40 prospect in our top 100. So opportunity plus top 40 prospect to me meant he automatically had to
see. And this is where we've had this discussion on other guys too. 21-year-old pitchers generally, if you said 21-year-old hitter, I'm much more likely. No matter how high we rank them, I expect a lot of these pitchers to struggle their first year, and then get better and better.
Right. Which
and
is if where we disagreed on Mike Montgomery.
Right.
Not making.
Because I am the Mike Montgomery, you know, if I'm not the president of the fan club, I'm at least I'm on the board.
I think I was president in 2009 and in 2010.
And I just took over.
You took that mantle when you saw him in Kinston, and you've run with it. And it doesn't mean that I don't like Mike Montgomery.
No, you like him a lot too, I think. But
I like him a lot. I had him in my top 20 rookies. I had him at 16. My contention is, we thought we were going to recreate this for last week's podcast. Now we're going to do it for this one. My contention is if you feel strongly enough, as you did, to rank him as a number one prospect in a Royals organization that had 2 other
potential
players who would be legitimate number one candidates in Bubba Starling and Will Myers, then it must follow, for me, that he's in your top 20 rookies. Because otherwise, I don't see how he's your number one if you don't think he's ready for big league success right off the bat. Because I don't think it's true that his ceiling is as high or even comparable to those guys. I don't think he's a number one, future number one. He might be a number two starter if it all comes together. He might be more legitimately a third starter. And to me, Will Myers is a prototype corner right fielder, and Bubba Starling is like a prototype five-tool, like a better version of Adam Jones, or like a prototype five-tool center fielder. So to me, if you didn't believe that Montgomery was polished enough to be a good
rookie. If I think he's
going to
be number two, which I do.
Right.
I would argue that a number two, like compare a number two to a – if he's a number two and Will Myers is a prototype right fielder, I want the number two.
I got you. I
left,
understand
especially
that.
Lefty number two.
I actually think it's pretty hard to find prototype right fielders.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think it's also even harder to find.
Right, but Will Myers I'm thinking prototype is like a 30-home run guy. I think Will Myers has that kind of offensive upside. He was number 10 in baseball all of last year. Maybe I'm giving him too much – entering last year. Maybe I'm giving him too much of a mulligan. But he had, what was it, a staph infection and a learning a new position and a 20-year-old in AA? If that doesn't get you a mulligan, I don't know what does.
Well, he does.
That gets me a bigger mulligan than struggling in AAA and the PCL when, you know, you're out of school for 3 years now. And yeah. So I was with you. I like Mike Montgomery. I buy he could be your number one
where
guy.
Where we disagree, and we've had discussion in the office, where we disagree is that I, when we're talking about a top 20 rookies list,
right,
my top 20 rookies list.
You're like you are to pitchers as Matt Eddy is to catchers. Matt thinks there's no way a catcher should ever make a rookie top 20 list.
My top 20 rookies list has more relievers than most guys do on it, because when we get down at the end of the year, and we had this discussion in that meeting,
right,
and there are people who said, you know, I'm not saying he's not going to have a good year, but this is our preseason list. I'm going to go with the guys with the higher upside and all that. But when we get done at the end of the year. We've had a whole lot of guys who at least are in the argument for rookie of the year at the end of the year, the Brad Zieglers.
Right, right.
You know.
By the way, Mike Montgomery's strikeouts per nine is 7.9. It's not so much higher than Jacob Turner, Mr. not dominating enough weak contact guy.
That is true.
So, Sorry, I got a little...
Someone forgot to turn their...
I did forget to turn my cell phone off, but at least we're not on the air. We're just on the podcast. So.
But my point is that I expect, my expectation... actually, it's going long enough. You got to turn it off now because it's going long enough. We may have to pay royalties on that.
Come on.
But
David Bowie's a relaxed kind of guy.
But so my thing is that my expectation for Mike Montgomery is this is the year that he takes the step to making it to the big leagues. And essentially, but I wouldn't be shocked at all if he had a half season in the big leagues, much like Danny Duffy had last year.
And see, I've thought about that too. He's better than Danny Duffy. If he's the number one guy, if he's a number two, he's better than Danny Duffy.
But he's not better than...
Is he not more prepared to be better than Danny Duffy?
He's not better than Greg Maddux, who had a 5.5 ERA as a rookie.
I follow you there. I'm not comparing him to those guys. I'm comparing him to Danny Duffy. Danny Duffy's from Lompoc, as I like to talk about. This guy's from Hart High School in Southern California. Danny Duffy was the big fish in a small pond. This guy was the number two starter on his high school team because of Trevor Bauer. Danny Duffy was rushed through with a horrible Royals team and an organization that was building talent, but he was at the front end of that wave. Montgomery's right in the meat of that. Got a full year of AAA, not as rushed as Duffy. To me, he's better prepared, more athletic, more talented.
No, I think he
should be better than Danny Duffy.
I expect him to be better than Duffy, but where we disagree is that I think, maybe I'm going too far on this, but it's not that there can't be pitchers who succeed as rookies, because obviously there can't, and there are a number of them.
Right.
But if you look at a list of the best pitchers in baseball, there are a whole lot of them who struggle that second year. I mean, obviously, Roy Halladay's the best pitcher in baseball.
I don't disagree with you.
And so my argument is that doesn't, to me... The two are, if you said who's going to have the best rookie year, my list is going to have a whole lot of position players and a whole lot of relief pitchers.
Right. I just think you're sending some conflicting signals when you have, if you had any starting pitchers on here at all, who besides Darvish and Moore, is none of the other guys, Tehran had a full year in AAA, Jared Parker's older but has already had Tommy John surgery. I don't even think he had a full year AAA.
But the other thing with that is that, and we talked about this also, the other reason, if Mike Montgomery was an A, I'd have him on my list.
You don't think he has opportunity in Kansas City?
No, I don't think he's going to. I think that the most he'll probably make is 15 starts this year.
Okay.
Whereas I think that Jared Parker, if he's healthy, is going to make 25 to 30.
We really are talking past each other on this because I really feel like if you've had him as the number one prospect, he's going to push his way past all that. I mean, that's what being a number one prospect does. That's all. I think I'm agreeing with your argument more on the rookie side than I am on the number one prospect side now, whereas before I was agreeing with you more on the number one prospect side because I believed – I liked the conviction, but I think the conviction has to carry over. To me, they're actually kind of incompatible.
To me, I do not have – again, I believe in – if you're talking about the next 6 to 8 years of Mike Montgomery,
right.
I am a staunch believer.
Right.
If you're talking about the beginning of the 2012 season, there is nothing I have right now. There is no
evidence –
We're
not talking about April. We're talking about 6 months.
We're talking about April and May and June too, though. And if you have – I have nothing. I have no evidence right now that says, for one, the Royals – contending, I still believe, is at least a year away.
Right.
If that's the case, there's no reason to bring him up early. For two, there are things...
I'll interrupt you there. The reason to bring him up as early is the rest of their pitchers stink.
But here's the thing. From a cost standpoint, like if you, again, like with Bryce Harper, you don't need him to make those starts. If you give those starts to Felipe Paulino in April and you see, okay, can he follow up what he did last year? That's more valuable to the Royals while keeping Montgomery from starting his clock. And there are legitimate things that Montgomery has to work on. Montgomery needs to have a better breaking ball. Montgomery needs to improve his command. So there's reasons to say, we're going to take it slow with you.
I'm agreeing with all those things. But to me, a number one prospect pushes through some of those issues that you've mentioned. Unless he's the number one in a bad system, and he's not. He's number one in a good system. So,
okay.
For me, they're incompatible.
We got some questions, so let's get to the questions so that we.
Yeah, we did. We actually, I did not think we'd be able to recreate
The passion.
Yeah, we both feel strongly about Mike Montgomery. The thing, I like him. I do like him. I actually, like I said, I had him.
We
in
both,
my top 20.
We both like him.
Douglas Cutler asks, and it's a. I won't even give you his handle. You can go on the Baseball America on our feed. Any worry about Lucas Giolito long term following his injury, and how likely is it that he heads to UCLA now? The news, our Nathan Rohde was helped break this news. Eric Sonheimer, of course, the LA Times also broke that news, kind of, I think, concurrently with Nathan. And that Lucas Giolito, who's the number one player on our high school top 100 prospects list, I think we had him number three on our combined prospects list.
I think, yeah, Buxton
list.
Was two, and he was...
No, he was ahead of Buxton because we switched. Yeah,
then who was it?
It was Devin Marrero was two, and okay. Mark Appel was one, if memory serves. I could be wrong. I might have had him at two. I guess I could always look that up at baseballamerica.com. But the Lucas Giolito came out of the start earlier this week. We're recording this on Thursday. He came out of a Tuesday start and was he is number two after Mark Appel. Well, now he's not going to be number two anymore because Lucas Giolito came out with a sprained right ulnar collateral ligament in his elbow. A sprain that basically means a small tear. So this is a pretty significant injury. He's going to be out a minimum of 6 weeks. More likely that it's going to be kind of in that 6 to 10 week. I've also talked to somebody who thought it was an 8 to 12 week injury. Well, the draft is about 13 weeks away, JJ. So it's a very good chance that Lucas Giolito will miss the rest of the high school season. We won't get to see him pitch here in the National High School Invitational Tournament that USA Baseball and Baseball America
are putting
on. I
think we'd all already been planning on basically a caravan over
there. I think Nathan was crushed that he was that. He took it personal, you know. He was crushed that Lucas Giolito was hurt. But our own Connor Glassy has already written an analytical piece about what teams could still take Giolito, what this is going to do for his draft. I mean, it's early to know, but JJ, he's not number two on the board anymore.
Well, I saw some people write yesterday, not for us, but other places, saying, hey, the closest parallel to this is Kyle Gibson and of recent years. And I got to disagree with that because those
too.
Are – Kyle Gibson's injury in this, they do not match because Kyle Gibson – I'll defer to you on the exact details because you both do our twins and you're, you know, more on the college side than us. 8 weeks before the draft?
I think it was like in May. It was like in late May. I thought it was the Big 12 tournament, actually.
And it was a stress fracture.
I think what they called it at first was like a stress reaction. Yeah,
right.
Something like that.
But the big difference being, the biggest difference being, you're talking about a college junior versus a high school senior. Which makes a dramatic difference to me because in Kyle Gibson's case, if you draft him, you can spend the summer evaluating, and you know that if you are confident in his health and you give him a reasonable deal, he's gonna go, likely because he doesn't have the leverage. If he doesn't, he's going to go back to school, be a senior. And his leverage largely goes out the window.
Yeah, so Kyle Gibson's injury, actually, we reported it on June 6th, 2009. So it was even later than I thought. He pitched on May 30th against Monmouth and Regionals. His fastball was 83-86, despite the fact that he threw 8 scoreless innings. So
but that's dramatically different.
Yes.
Then to me, the parallel for this, the one that jumps out the most is, and we immediately both thought of, Nick Adenhart.
Yeah, because first it's high school to high school.
Which does make a big difference, because when Nick Adenhart had the injury, pretty much at that time, I think the general reaction we had around our office was, well, we'll be seeing him pitching in Chapel Hill next year.
That's exactly what we all thought. Of course, we didn't know that he was going to wind up decommitting from North Carolina, would have wound up either going maybe to Arizona State or to South Carolina.
Right. All of a sudden, that commitment became a lot more important. It wasn't just a put something down because
that's
I'm going
right.
to go pro.
Well, I think he was really – I think well, actually what happened was that – he was very close with Trent Klein, who was a catcher at North Carolina as a freshman. But after an injury-plagued freshman season in North Carolina, Trent Klein wound up transferring to a junior college in Florida, and that was a big part of Nick Adenhart's commitment to North Carolina was his friendship with Trent Klein, and they played on travel teams. We're speaking for the late Nick Adenhart now. So a tragic. Absolutely. His story is a tragic story in a lot of ways, an inspirational story in some ways, too. And he came back from the Tommy John surgery and made the major leagues. But the point is he got hurt early in the high school season.
And Nick Adenhart at that time,
he was not the number one guy on the high school list.
Lucas Giolito was. He wasn't touching 100.
Correct.
That being said, He was the consensus number one pitching prospect, high school pitching prospect, in that draft.
He absolutely was. And he wound up being drafted in the 14th round and signing late for $710,000. And it's going to take, I think, more money to pull Lucas Giolito away from UCLA, precisely because, like we were just talking about with Aiden Hart, I don't think his commitment to North Carolina had changed. And he wanted to play pro ball. He wound up being a bargain for the Angels, and that they got a major leaguer out of him. And then, obviously, like you said, his career and his life tragically cut short by completely mindless drunk driving.
Trust me when we say that we, in our office, that we all remember exactly where we were when we heard that news. That was a shocking
opening day. That was opening day.
And shocking opening day.
I was at a Charlotte Knights game against the Gwinnett.
Julio Teheran pitcher?
No, it was Tommy Hansen and Chris Medlin.
Yeah.
Which was awesome because Chris Medlin and Tommy Hansen were both tremendous that day, and they're both neat guys. Enjoyed interviewing them. But it was a pall over that whole day with the Nick Aidenhart news. It was a horrible day as far as that goes. It really put a damper on opening day. And you just can't imagine that organization. You look at their farm system and those kind of things. The players who played with them, you just can't imagine what it – I don't know how you go through a whole season with that. And the Angels obviously making the playoffs that year is a pretty inspirational story. We digress. Nick Aidenhart is a parallel to Giolito, and then it happened early in the year. I think that Giolito's commitment to UCLA is pretty strong. His family, we're going to write this feature coming up. Both his parents have acted. I don't think he's going to sign for $710,000, JJ.
And the thing that Connor's story today points out, there are ways. Now, the thing you will not see happen, almost assuredly, you don't want to give absolutes in any of this. In Aidenhart's case, what the old system allowed you to do, He keeps slipping. You take him in the 14th round.
Right.
And then if you take him in the 14th round and he doesn't sign for the money that you were looking to give him, you just shrug your shoulders and go, okay, well, that was worth the risk.
Exactly.
It was a 14th round pick.
Right.
That's probably not what's going to happen with Giolito because, for one thing, you're going to have to do it in the top 10 rounds.
Right.
Unless you just say, well, we're just going to take the penalty.
Yeah, exactly.
If he's not drafted by round 10, the chances of Giolito signing fall to infinitesimally small levels.
I agree, and I think he's had to be ahead of UCLA.
But if you take him, especially what Connor spelled out, if you've got two first-round picks, the key thing it's going to come down to, and I've heard this, the thing we keep hearing about the new CBA and the new draft rules and all, more than anything is that with the area scouts, and this is not cross-checkers, this is not the GM coming in taking the
right.
This is on area scouts. The area scouts are going to have to know pretty well what your number is.
Yep.
And Giolito is going to be more than anything because if you know, hey, if healthy, we can get him at, let's say it's $4 million. There are teams out there who can make that work in their draft.
Right.
But you have to essentially build your draft around the idea that you're taking him.
And a $4 million bonus is a reasonable number to throw out there because that's what Dylan Bundy got for signing bonus last year. But the difference is, Dylan Bundy got that as part of a major league contract, and those are now precluded under the new CBA. So,
but
it's going to be fascinating
this
to see, Doug.
I
think it's a great question.
If you're expecting him to get six or so before, four is close enough to that number. And obviously, we're not in part of the Giolito family. You have to figure each player has to figure these things out. But then it's still in that number where you're saying, okay, well, I know that the number I could get, the maximum number.
Right.
In a couple of years, it's going to be like 7.5.
Right.
Is it worth that risk when I got this much money coming now?
And the other part of that is we don't know how serious the injury is in 6 to 8 weeks when he starts throwing again or 10 weeks, whatever it is. He may decide. He may not have healed enough, and might be Tommy John surgery.
Right. This may not preclude Tommy. I mean, there's no way you can say right now. No, anyone can say, well, he doesn't have to have Tommy John. That he doesn't need Tommy John yet.
And then you kind of have the decision, like a guy like Dylan Covey had, or like Nick Aidenhart had. Do you want to do that rehab at the amateur level in college, or do you want to do that rehabilitation at the professional level? And I can't answer that question for you. I think Lucas Giolito is going to have to answer that question. So it's a fascinating storyline to watch as the draft year unfolds. JJ, we have one other question, and then we can probably wrap up. From Woe Doctor, that's a good Ernie Harwell in the Avatar, and it's also obviously his phrase. Padres are moving Casey Kelly, to the left side of the rubber and speeding up his tempo. Good, bad, inconsequential. I love the speeding up the tempo part. I mean, I guess we both grew up watching the Braves, so I just remember when they did that with Larry McWilliams. It sticks out in my head for some reason. They sped up Larry McWilliams, and it was his big year in 1982, was due in part to his increased tempo. Lucas Giolito, some of his improvement this spring with his velocity jump, was due in part to improving his tempo, actually.
It's funny. Every now and then, you hear that a lot more than every now and then you hear, we had to slow down his tempo.
That's right.
You don't hear that nearly as much. Every now and then, like, this guy just...
Hair on fire. Yeah. I think improving Casey Kelly's tempo probably helps. He sounds like he's a... you want his athleticism to take over. The side of the rubber really does affect this. This was an issue with Matt Moore, JJ. We talked about it last year with Matt Moore, allowing him to pitch more to his glove side and get his fastball inside the right-handed hitters with the adjustments he made on the rubber.
The good, bad, or inconsequential, here's the answer I can give on that, which is a cop-out. But it's good because they realize that something – we need to be tweaking some things.
That's right.
What we're doing, the stuff is not adding up to the results that we expected. So let's analyze this and try to figure out what can be done to improve that.
I will direct you, Mr. Woe Doctor, to if you go to under the college dropdown, my column is under the college dropdown. It just says – it's the last column on the dropdown. It says John Manuel. And then you have with pitchers, tiny tweaks can make a big difference. That was a whole column I wrote about standing on the rubber because I'm interested in that. And so, yeah, like JJ talked about earlier in the podcast, pretty much anything pitching – We'll report on it, and we'll try to get into why would you do that kind of thing, and wow, that's really interesting. Usually, you know, so we definitely like talking about that kind of stuff.
So, yeah, I think I do think. Obviously, we'll see the results. You know, 6 months from now, we'll have an answer to that question because sometimes you make a tweak like this, and it doesn't make a difference.
Right.
Sometimes you find a pitcher finds I'm not comfortable over there.
Right.
But sometimes it can be the thing. Again, the Matt Moore. Oh, I'm going to move, you know, I'm going to change the break of my hands a little bit and how I bring my hands up.
Right.
And all of a sudden, everything comes together. That's where pitching's fascinating. That's where pitching, it's so hard. Like, when you're talking about ranking prospects and all, with pitchers, with the hitter, not that there can't be improvements, not that you can't have a guy who makes a mechanical adjustment and finds that all of a sudden he's not vulnerable to the inside fastball or things
right.
like that. But hitting's a much more gradual. Generally, a guy either has hand-eye, like, you have the hand-eye or you don't.
Right.
And then you make adjustments from
that. You have the rhythm or you don't, you know.
Right. But with pitchers, it can be, this guy's not any good, this guy's really struggling, this guy doesn't have a chance. Oh, I found something. Oh, and tomorrow it's all better.
I mean, there's so
many. Or the other way around.
That's right. There's so many different pitches you can throw, so many different mechanics that people do. There's different arm slots. With a hitter, basically, unless you – there was one Craig Counsell. There really weren't very many other guys that had crazy stances like that. You have different stances. But
the funny thing about that is – and I would argue that it does seem like we have less crazy stances.
And we do. Isn't that weird? I just was about to say, at least like in the 80s, you had like the Lau school – and then you had completely different standing. You had like Larry Parrish.
And you have Brian Downing, who to
not
me
Larry
is...
Parrish, Lance Parrish, who was like super stand up straight. Brian Downing, like you said, he was like super open. You had George Hendrick, who was super
Julio
closed.
Julio Franco, who basically like, I will point the bat at you. I will point it at you.
Where's batting stance guy when we need him? We need to have him on the show.
But yeah, and now you don't see that many. You don't see that many stances where you go, wow, that's just different.
Now that Craig Counsell has retired, who has the craziest stance in the major leagues?
That's a great question. I can't. No one's coming out. Yeah, if you have an answer for that, tweet us at Baseball America, at John Manuel BA, or at JJ Coop 36, or comment on our Facebook page. I'll throw it on our Facebook page when we're done with this podcast.
Juan Uribe has kind of a unique stance, but there's no more Jeff Bagwell. You know, the bear squatting in the woods.
The best way I can put it is there's all these guys who immediately when you say it, you picture it in your head.
Yeah, absolutely. Like and Chipper. Like, Chipper has, I would say, distinctive,
but it's not something.
It's not totally unique, but it is distinctive.
Right, but it's also it's kind of if you're a hitting coach, you'd say, okay, I'd teach that.
Yeah, it's oft copied. That's what sticks out in my head. Is that
whereas like if no one's seeing Brian Downing stance and going, yeah, I'd teach that.
I think that this is probably a story. There's probably a story in the batting stance because actually I think I have talked about this with a scouting director. It's starting to come back to me now that because the hitters are more homogenous these days because of the preponderance of private hitting clinics.
And they're not going to teach you. No one's figuring it out on their own as much.
That's it, because there's less pickup baseball, basically. There's so much less sandlot.
There's
baseball.
Less something where you're saying, I'm just going to try something crazy. Oh, it works for me.
Well, you don't even think it's crazy. It's just natural. It just comes natural to you, and you aren't looking in a mirror.
Hank Aaron's not going to bat backwards.
Exactly. You're also not seeing it in video. I bet you there are hitting coaches who take their 12-year-olds and, you know, break them down on video for a price, and that's where the game has gone. So I think we may have answered our own question, but it might be worth a comment.
It's worth a story, sounds like.
I think it's worth a little more investigation. We hope this was worth your hour here on the Baseball America podcast. It was for us. We have a lot of fun doing these. We thank you for the download. And if you have questions, again, you can send those into us either via email, podcast@baseballamerica.com, or @baseballamerica@JJCoop36, @JohnManuelBA on Twitter. For JJ Cooper, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next week on the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.